Charles Freck, becoming progressively more and more depressed by what was happening around him, decided finally to off himself. There was no problem in the circles where he hung out in putting an end to yourself. You just bought a large quantity of downers and took them with some cheap wine. The planning part had to do with the artifacts he wanted found on him by later archaeologists. He had spent several days deciding, much longer than he had spent deciding to kill himself. He would be found lying on his back, on his bed, with a copy of Ayn Rand's The Fountainhead and an unfinished letter to Exxon protesting the cancellation of his gas credit card. That way, he would indict the system and achieve something by his death.
Episode 97 of the Cult of Matt and Mark Cult Film Review Podcast. I'm Matt.
And I'm Mark.
And make sure to hit our blog at cultfilmreview.blogspot.com or shoot us an email at cultfilmreview@gmail.com. Show news. Got any show news this week?
Show news. Oh, I'm playing Demon Souls again. Pretty excited.
What happened to Dragon's Throne?
Crown.
Sorry.
I got a little burnt out on it. I was trying to finish the... they make you go through the game three times at increasing difficulty levels. And I was having a little trouble beating the last boss on the... I think they call it insane or something difficulty.
Insane.
So I got a little burnt out.
Yeah, I could see that. Boy, that's milking it if you ask me.
That's a pretty fun game. Things get really crazy on the screen. You remember those old side-scrolling shooters back from the day where there was all sorts of stuff moving around the screen? Part of the learning process was learning how to make sense of all that visual chaos on the screen.
Right.
And that's sort of how this game gets. I mean, the screen just is just a literally just nothing but an explosion of light and graphics, and somehow you're supposed to keep track of where you are in respect to enemies and stuff. That's sort of part of it.
I was playing the original Far Cry once, which is an impossibly fucking hard game, even on the normal level. And I remember I went to a cheat code. I threw up my hands, and it was like you could be invincible, so you don't die. You just kind of, like, your health goes to 100 or to 0%, and then you respawn right there. And the end boss scene was literally so crazy that my screen was strobing red. That's how quickly I was dying. It was like strobing, like it was just like pulses of red. I died like 50 times a minute or something like that. It was crazy.
Yeah, I've heard that the third Far Cry game is pretty good, but
better.
I don't play that many games these days. I just don't have the time. So I'm usually pretty. You know, I got a hectic life, lots of responsibilities.
You got a lot to do, man. That's right.
So what are you drinking tonight there, Matthew?
Drinking Ardbeg Ugadul, and you are drinking...
The Belvini 12-year Doublewood.
Nice. Show news on my end. I saw a trailer for Old Boy, the remake.
That's going to be awesome, man. We're going to be there opening night. Let's cosplay.
Let's cosplay. Okay, you'll be... And I'll be, oh, shit.
You'll be doing me hard in the ass, and it'll really hurt, but I'll endure anyways because I love you so much.
Spoilers alert. No, you know who's in it? The third Olsen sister. You didn't know there was one, but Elizabeth Olsen or something like that.
Oh, the younger one. I think she's been in some films before. She's supposed to be pretty good.
Yeah, well, she's not so emaciated and strung out as her other two twin sisters. Let's see what else in show news. Oh, I'm done listening to fucking Adam Carolla. I'm done listening to that idiot.
I
deleted
what
fucking feeds.
What broke the camel's back this time?
Anybody that creates a worldview from anecdotal observation is basically an idiot. And the problem with him is that he's so surrounded by sycophants in his little online podcast world that they reinforce that nonsense, sort of like, you know, kind of the Rush Limbaugh hermetic bubble.
The ditto heads?
They just start living in their own world.
Blow me up, Tom!
And, like, he's gotten... Yeah, blow me up, Tom. He's gotten, like, more crotchety as his podcasts go. And it's just like he's recycling the same fucking mommy issues about lazy people on welfare and libertarian ideology and blah, blah, blah. And then he brought up my company and my company's threat to leave the area for cheap scab labor.
Yeah.
And I was like, okay, I'm fucking done with you, dude. I am totally done. And then I just deleted all his shit and I'm not listening to him anymore. So,
well, look, Adam
Carolla.
He's a smart guy in his own way. He's a hard worker. If anything, he's got a motor, which I think accounts for more than anything in our society.
Right.
With just dogged, endless persistence to never stop trying no matter what happens. It's really the feature of people's personalities that our society fosters more than any other. He's got it, and he just never stops working. He gets up in the morning and just goes.
It's fine, man. But really, the nonsense about government meddling, where he thinks government, you know, he pictures government as the guys that hold up his permits when he wants to put an addition onto his house. You know, I don't think he realizes the government that people are complaining about, and that's not, you know. Anyway, long story. I don't want to get into it, but I'm done.
I listen to a show sometimes, and if he goes on a bent, I just delete the episode.
Nope. He brought up my company, and I am fucking out. Sorry.
I didn't know you were so supportive of the various unions that are involved.
You know, whatever asshole said that as you get older, you get more conservative, I want to punch that fucker in the face because I am going the opposite direction. As I get older, I'm getting like way more commie socialist. It's crazy. Like I want to move out of the country to some, you know, sort of mellow socialist country in Western Europe. I'm so done.
You want to stop owning property?
Dude, I'm not talking about collectivism, for fuck's sake. I'm just talking about a little higher taxes so we can take care of our people.
This is the same commie pinkle bullshit I've heard a million times before. Right.
Okay, that's my Adam Carolla rant. So let's get on with the movie. We've stretched this out way too long. Our movie this week is the 2006 A Scanner Darkly by Richard Linklater. Plot rundown. The war on drugs has been lost, and when a reluctant undercover cop is ordered to spy on those he is closest to, the toll that the mission takes on his sanity is too great to comprehend in director Richard Linklater's rotoscoped take on Philip K. Dick's classic novel. Bob Arctor, played by Keanu Reeves, is a narcotics officer who is issued an order to spy on his friends and report back to headquarters. In addition to being a cop, though, Arctor is also an addict. His drug of choice is a ubiquitous street drug called Substance D, a drug known well for producing split personalities in its users. There you go. Plot rundown.
Oh, that's nice. Except I got to have a disagreement right from the beginning that the drug war had been lost. If anything, this movie takes an interesting take on the war on terror and sort of transmutes it into a war on drugs gone wild. Now, certainly the war on drugs has been and continues to be an absolute bullshit-a-thon. But the war on terror has really taken that bullshit to a whole new level. And I think this movie sort of asks, well, how about if the war on drugs had really taken the bullshit to a whole new level? Because they were sort of a 9/11 type drug equivalent.
Well, okay, so for starters, talking about the war on drugs, war on terror, whatever, war on a verb.
What I wanted to say, I'm sorry, I gotta get back to this here.
All
right. It's not over in this movie. It's in full swing, the war on drugs.
Okay, well, war is lost. It's not a conventional war. That's what's retarded about calling something where you war on something other than a nation state entity.
The middle class.
Yeah, war on the middle class. Fuck you, Adam. Okay, anyway. But the thing is that what I think this movie touches on, or at least what I got out of it with the whole, new path is the amount of money that is involved with any war on something that you can never win, like terror or drugs. And with the war on drugs, what I found great about this movie is that they're dealing the drugs and then they're getting money for the rehabilitation where you pay money to get rehabilitated off that drug.
It's a perfect cycle. That's why the McDonald's Corporation is the primary holder of laparoscopic surgical bands.
Are you serious?
Yeah.
Isn't that crazy? Fucking awesome, dude. That's so Orwellian. Yeah, awesome.
Well, the aliens came from Alpha Centauri and gave them that technology. That's why it's been such a boom. And
well, it reminds me of that one judge back in Pennsylvania who was getting paid off by the local private prison to sentence young people to harsh sentences so he could fill up his private juvenile facility.
Oh, man, that's another case of government gone wild. Pull me up, Tom!
So the amount of money that circulates in the war on drugs, it's in Washington State where we live. We legalized marijuana recently, but it's still obviously illegal under federal law.
Well, I can't go down to the corner and get a J. Which I would
not
really
yet.
Like. All I could do
not
is
yet,
rage
sir.
War on these bottles of scotch.
Not yet, sir. Just hold your horses. So the DEA gets a shit ton of money. They're a paramilitary organization that the United States government funds to eradicate illegal drugs sources, domestic and foreign.
And the occasional democratically elected president.
And right. And so we kind of extort a lot of these third world countries in South America to allow our DEA agents to run wild. And they're running around in Black Hawk helicopters, paramilitary forces. A ton of money is involved in it. A ton of money for the contractors that supply the weaponry and ordnance and logistics for these for the DEA. And so it's an industry. It's a taxpayer-funded industry.
Well, considering that Keanu Reeves is in this movie, you should probably say the DEA.
Oh, I'm a DEA. No, he's an FBI agent.
I know, but for this movie.
Point Break, I know. I'm a DEA agent, Donna. All right. So to decommission that huge infrastructure that is the DEA, a lot of people are going to be out of jobs. A lot of people are going to be, you know, missing their little corrupt take out of the whole thing. And it's a self-perpetuating machine, and like Homeland Security, which is basically a payout to contractors and such based on, I guess, the paranoia of the American people willing to write a check for it, then there's a lot of money there. And so the new path is awesome because it just ties the loop up nicely. It's just, here's your rehab. The rehabilitated drug users go and farm the new drug to create more users and so on and so forth. And they're just making money on it, you know, from the dealing to the rehabilitation, all that good stuff. So I thought that was – Philip K. Dick was a paranoid – he's kind of marginal paranoid schizophrenic. So his paranoia, though, in this day and age is prescient because there's not only – the whole new path concept and how ridiculous it seemed when he wrote the novel, when I read the novel, but is seeming to be a lot more realistic and factual in this day and age. I don't know. Thoughts?
Well, did he have a junk habit?
Oh, no. He was a speed freak.
Okay.
I read his biography. I forget. It's sitting up on my shelf, but I don't want to slow down the podcast.
Did he go in and out of rehab? So he was familiar with the process of rehabilitation. And maybe he tried a 12-step-like program. You got that little bit of a feeling out of rehab where you sort of take a doctrine and absorb it into yourself and sort of replace your own sense of morality with this new code that allows you to avoid drug use. I just wonder, did he go through that at all?
Well, I can't remember reading
anything about that.
Well, he had suicide attempts. He was married 5 fucking times, if you can believe that. Isn't that crazy? Married 5 times.
Got a lot of tail.
Oh, no. No, that's the deal. He only slept, like you could say, those are the 5 women that he slept with during his life.
He's doing pretty good.
He was extremely insecure. Uh-huh. Reading that biography, I don't even see how he was dateable. He was kind of pathetic, sort
Everybody
of,
needs a warm body to snuggle up with at night, no matter how
dude.
Repulsive you are.
He is a needy dude.
Hey, Charles Manson's got a new fiance.
I hear that.
There's somebody for everyone.
Congrats to Charles.
And she's like 19.
Really?
And I heard she's not too bad looking, though. She's crazy.
You think?
Could you imagine?
Just think of the vast fortune she will inherit upon his death.
Really? There's Manson sitting on a pile of toilet paper or something?
I don't know. He might have a right to a Beach Boys song or two, so rumor has it. But what was I talking about? Oh, Philip K. Dick. Married five times. This, I guess, a Scanner Darkly is sort of a semi-autobiographical view of the house that he was living in for a period of time in the Bay Area after one of his wives left him. And he was a speed freak. And so he, that's what he did to write. He would, and it just enhanced whatever borderline psychosis that the man was dealing with at the time. So
well,
he would
speed. I wonder who the autobiographical character was. I mean, the speed freak, obviously, in this movie seems to be Barris.
Well, it's speed freak. This is a fake. This is a fake drug, substance D, whatever. So it's just it's an analog.
But these characters are using all sorts of drugs. They talk about marijuana and cocaine and alcohol, and it seems like Downey's the guy that's hitting the methamphetamines.
Yeah, because he's man, he's great.
He's manic.
Robert Downey Jr. is great. He's just doing.
Was he
thing.
Still on drugs during this film? Was this before or after he got clean? Because he got clean, and then all of a sudden he started making money hand over fist doing action movies.
I think he was definitely mining his experiences. Mm-hmm. He definitely, obviously, he knew what it was like to be high and just totally fucked out and having nonsense conversations. Because I have a feeling a lot of it was ad-libbing.
The one thing about this movie is the paranoia, obviously. That's a overriding.
All right, I got to get through the Philip K. Dick.
Oh, okay, go ahead.
Before we get too far off topic here. So he would do speed and he would crank out like a novel a week because that's how he made his money. And while he was kind of a creepy dude if you were a younger person because he was like this 45-year-old guy high on speed living in this trashed house that his family used to live in but moved out because of his habit and his psychosis. And then he just kind of filled it full of drug people. And drug people would, like, rip him off constantly. I think he lost a ton of manuscripts that way. He befriended, like, a really young girl, like 18 or 19, and she viewed the relationship platonically. But, of course, he was needy, and I think she slept with him once or something. But, anyway, it was that experience that created the world that A Scanner Darkly takes place in, sort of a druggy house. You know, full trashed house, full. And the Bob Arctor character is the Philip K. Dick character, you know, because you get those images of a family that once was and have long left him due to his habit. So anyway, I don't know, a little bit of Scanner Darkly was the first Philip K. Dick book I read. And I read, God, I have so much fucking Philip K. Dick on my shelf, but I realized he's not that good of a writer at a certain point.
Did his... The end of this film has some text where the movie's dedicated to people he's lost.
Correct.
Was that actually a postscript to the book?
I don't have the book on hand because I borrowed it from Travis when I first read it. I don't know. I believe it's in there. I would assume it's in there.
I mean, are those people who were lost to drugs? Or people he lost due to drugs?
I think people he knew that died or had psychoses with whatever psychotropic drug they were taking at the time. I don't know really specifically.
It is strange. You know, this movie seems to have a strange reverence for Philip K. Dick in the sense that it seems like this movie... And I haven't read the book, doggedly follows the plot of the book. Does it? Even including the resolution?
Yes, it does. And this is why I like A Scanner Darkly so much, because it's not the most bombastic, sleek version of a Philip K. Dick reinterpretation. I mean, he's been sort of hot property for a while in Hollywood recently. But it's crazy how many movies you've seen, sci-fi classics that were Philip K. Dick based. There's Blade Runner, Total Recall, which are two of my favorite science fiction movies. There's actually a really good one with Peter Weller called
Screamers.
Screamers based on like a second variety. Third variety or something. That was actually a fairly pure interpretation of his short story.
Yeah, this is a novel.
This is a full novel. And then there's Minority Report, which I think you hate and I dislike, by Steven Spielberg. The Adjustment Bureau.
I don't like a Spielberg film? I never.
Adjustment Bureau, Paycheck, that turd.
I think I actually watched it on TBS or something.
Yeah, the list goes on. But Scanner Darkly was Linkletter's sort of reverence towards Philip K. Dick's material, and he really wanted to do it right, and I think he did with this movie, and really treated the source material with care and wrote the script with care and got it right. And that's why I like this movie so much, because the rotoscoping, I think, gives it sort of that. I know you're not a fan. I didn't mind.
Well, I changed my opinion of the rotoscoping. I actually enjoyed it quite a bit on this viewing. This is the second time I've seen the film, and I didn't have a problem with it. I think it was probably a really great way to handle the scramble suits, or what do they call them?
Yeah, scramble suits. Right.
And I thought it was nicely done. Yeah, I thought.
I
liked it quite a bit, and I don't have a problem at all with the rotoscoping. I don't know if it was absolutely necessary, but I think it certainly made sense within the tone of the film.
Well, then you can throw in some crazy shit like people turning into giant cockroaches, and it doesn't look cheesy or weird or doesn't blow the budget. You know, it's just another animation trick.
No, it's a good idea. I don't understand Woody Harrelson's hairdo, though. It makes no sense.
Is it a wig?
It's got to be. It looks like he used a mop and just put it over his head like he was going to do a cheesy, shaggy impression for Halloween.
Right. So what were we talking about?
We were going on all sorts of directions. My question was, I guess, about the reverence that the movie has for the source material. In a way, I guess maybe I have a problem with the storyline in and of itself. It doesn't totally make sense to me.
Well,
I like the mood and I like the tone and I enjoy the confusion of Bob. But the whole idea about this war on drugs and then this New Path company that somehow is producing the drug, it just seems pretty far-fetched to me.
Well, this is one of the more less fetched, is that a word? Books that Philip K. Dick has written start to finish. A lot of his shit, man, is really just kind of disintegrates halfway through the novel into just a bizarre kind of psychedelic, paranoid landscape that fails its plot miserably.
Well, the plot sort of disappears. In a way, I guess, that's not what I really have a problem with. It's that the movie tries to tie things up in a nice bow at the end instead of letting things just dissolve into mayhem.
Well, that's how the book ended.
I thought it was a little too cute.
All right. Well, the thing is, okay, one thing about Philip K. Dick, and it's one of the reasons that he's one of my favorite authors, it's not his writing. His writing is subpar, probably because he was, looped out on speed and cranking the stuff out really quick, and you can't take a lot of care when you're doing that.
Well, was it going to be published in pornography magazines?
No, he was pulp, man. He was in the pulp ghetto of sci-fi, was a ghetto that he hated, but it was before the time that sci-fi writers really embraced the ghetto and enjoyed the pulpy aspects of it. He was an idea guy, and that's the reason I really like him, is because he threw out crazy ideas, and this was in the 70s in the new wave of sci-fi writers, as they called them, where it's just generating a lot of ideas about society and mirroring, I guess, current events that really hadn't necessarily come to pass yet, but were well on their way. And Philip K. Dick, if you want to summarize him up in one word, it's paranoia. And every one of his novels, save a few, are highly leveraged on paranoia and the concept of paranoia. And it's because he had a mental illness partly, but there's an element of paranoia that we live under at the moment. And a lot of us are could give a shit, you know. But like the NSA. The NSA is reading all your emails. I'm like, oh, fuck that. No, they're not. Well, hey,
well,
they
there's
are.
Likely a like some sort of robot, some sort of program reading all your emails.
Understood.
Almost certainly.
Well, understood, but still.
But still what?
They're reading all your emails. I mean, did you already know that? Was that a revelation? It didn't really surprise me, although they are, you know. So if you're a little
well,
paranoid.
You know, how am I supposed to acquire my bomb-making materials?
Through the Look, anarchist cookbook.
Dick Cheney's grave's not going to blow itself up after he dies. That's all I got to say.
Wow.
What am I going to do? Get a U-Haul truck and fill it full of fertilizer and kerosene? Is that what you do? I can't remember how they blew up
either.
That building.
I think
in
you put orange
Oklahoma.
Juice and styrofoam and a box of matches. The fuck? I don't know.
I got to get some nitric acid and some glycerol. I'll be right back.
All I got to say is if they spend one Pinkerton salary on defending Dick Cheney's grave, that will be a worse crime of corruption of government than the 2008 financial crisis and bailout. That's
what is
saying.
A Pinkerton salary?
You know what Pinkertons are?
I have no idea.
Pinkertons are like a security agency that's been around for 150 years. They're just security guards. They guard industrial sites. They're just security service. They used to guard like banks and trains back in the Old West, like the 310 to Yuma. Peter Fonda is a Pinkerton in that film, and before he gets attacked by Russell Crowe's gang. I don't even remember that. Anyway.
No.
I don't even know how I got on that topic. Anyway, they spend one Pinkerton salary on defending Dick Cheney's grave. It will be a travesty, a crime upon the taxpayer.
Oh, well, whatever. blowing up Cheney's grave aside. the movie...
piss on it like everybody else. Okay, so anyway,
what? I mean, it seems like paranoia is not something that really bothers you at all.
Me?
Yeah.
I'm not really that paranoid, and I don't think I should be, but I'm not. And one of the reasons is because I feel there's 330 million Americans that the amount of time to process everybody through some kind of information filter to really get into their garbage is just – it's too much overhead, too much overhead. I know they're building like a gigantic – what's like the biggest unit of memory that they've come up with? Like giga, tera,
peta,
meta, teta, whatever,
peta. P-E-T-A.
Yeah.
That's like a million
terabytes or something. Yeah. A petabyte facility in Utah.
Well, that's not really that much. That's just like, oh, that's 1,000. I mean, you
I don't
can
know,
buy
man.
Like
it's like
4 terabyte hard drive.
It's like 100,000 square feet.
I think it's exabyte.
Okay. No, exabyte? Really? Oh, yeah. Like 100,000 square feet of server space in Utah for the NSA to store everybody's shit.
And the Mormon church is going to be running it. It's a cabal.
Oh, that's fucking awesome. Awesome. I never thought about that conspiracy.
Well, you're confusing reasonable paranoia. Let's just say you're part of some group that's been outlawed by your country, like for whatever reason, or you know, there's reasonable paranoia where you actually have enemies that have the means to disrupt your activities, right?
And you should be paranoid about those enemies.
And you should. You should. Yeah. You know, that's why encryption exists. And that's why, you know, vetting people and corporate espionage prevention methods and all that. But then I think what Dick's dealing with more so is more of a paranoia as a dysfunction of a sick mind.
Well, right. And having it be heightened by our modern condition is something that's exceptional. And you know, I was watching this movie, and the whole deal is that you have an individual who's taken a drug, and he's an agent, but then his life in the drug house is sort of opaque to his life as an agent watching himself in the drug house to the point that he confuses that person that he's looking at. And then there's this sort of schism played exceptionally well by always stoned looking Keanu Reeves, which having Keanu Reeves play a burned out dazed stoner is really where Keanu Reeves should stay. As far as his acting career, that's where he does things
where,
the best.
Does he go anywhere else? I think he's pretty aware of his limitations.
Well, sometimes, man, he's starting. He's like, oh, what was that? The Devil's Advocate? Oh, God. Oh,
I didn't
see
that.
Keanu Reeves travesty. He tries a southern accent, that's all I'm saying. It's terrible.
How about The Lake House?
The Lake House? I never saw The Lake House.
That's a good chick flick. I've never seen it either.
Well, he delves into the romantic comedies or the romantic films since he's such a hunky-looking dude, but it fails again. So he has to be the kind of the stone days, whoa, kind of Ted character, or things don't really work out for Keanu in movies that well. And this is a perfect movie for Keanu because he's exactly that. So he plays this dazed dude, and there's a schism, and he's observing himself. And it comes down to, as I was watching it, thinking of yourself objectively and thinking of yourself subjectively, which is always how you think of yourself. And like, I was trolling through Facebook the other day, and I was like, well, I'll look at my timeline, see what I was posting in 2011. And it's kind of a surreal experience because you're like, it's just posts. It's nothing really intimate. I don't really post anything intimate or anything. But you're looking at yourself objectively at that point, and it's kind of weird. You're kind of seeing stuff that you're like, oh, man, that's sort of an asshole thing to do, or what the fuck was I thinking when I put that up, or, you know, that sort of thing. And when I think of myself objectively, I get kind of weirded out. I get really insecure. I get embarrassed. And it sort of makes me a little paranoid and shameful. I don't know if you've ever done that, where you like think about a party a few weeks later that you were at, where you might have made a fool out of yourself, and just like, oh, Jesus Christ. You know, that's sort of the way it goes for most people.
Oh, yeah, yeah, all the time. Yeah, well, especially when I'm in
party rounds.
Especially when I'm in a pissy mood and tell somebody to go fuck themselves. Like a friend of mine's mother. I totally.
Argument
with her. But he accused her of neglecting her own parents.
That's pretty harsh for a grocery store small talk, I guess.
It was
say.
Bar small talk.
Bar small talk. Yeah. And did you kind of like feel like shit, or were you proud, or did you not care?
Well,
what happened
in a way, most of the times it's best not to speak the truth, even if it is true.
I know. It's hard not to do that, though, man.
You should just lie at every moment of your life. And I find that's a better policy.
Isn't that crazy, that whole front that you have to constantly maintain of...
Well, telling other people they're bad people, nobody wants to hear that they're a bad person, even though they are.
But,
I don't want to hear that, and I'm a terrible person.
Well, I call it picking your battles, really. You got to pick your battles, and picking your battles is a hard thing to do for a lot of folks. It's something that really it's a way to – it's not really lying, but it's a way to convince yourself that saying the truth is – or not saying the truth is good policy, and I do it a lot. I'm like, I want to – like at work, especially people in other parts of the country that I have to work with that I don't see day to day. I just want to say, oh, you're just such a fucking idiot. You know, I just want to like unload and tell them to go fuck themselves and everything. And it's not something you want to do at work. It's bad policy. Pick your battle. But it's just, man, you just want to tell them off so bad. Is that what you're talking about? Just telling people off?
Yeah, I told somebody off at work last week. And now I realize I need to apologize to him tomorrow.
How did you do it? I want to hear
it. They were just criticizing something that I did, which was I was not following policy.
You say it? Details.
I told him not to waste my time.
Don't waste my time.
Is what I said. And they said, what? I said, don't waste my time.
Was it a superior or
no,
was
not,
it
not really.
Just somebody?
Like, it was somebody at equal level.
Wow. That's crazy. That's what, you know, it feels good for a little while.
Not really. I was in the middle of something else. I didn't really be bugged. So sort of my natural animal instincts came out, told them to fuck off.
I have never told anybody to not waste my time. Even
I told them to talk to my superior if they wanted to complain about it, which is probably not the best way to do it. Not that I care that much, but it's just there's no reason to be mean to people if you don't need to be. So now I got to go apologize.
You know what I love doing, which is picking on people on the phone, like customer service people. I view it as some kind of fencing match where I get a difficult person who's like at a credit card company or airline company, whatever, trying to get them to do what I want because I know human beings are in the mix. And when there's human beings in the mix, policy isn't necessarily – there's policy and good business, and they're two different things most of the time. And so I'll just relish the fight, getting on the line, trying to exact what I want out of customer service people on the phone. And I will burn so much time on hold, calling them back to get like $10 for free. It's just, I don't feel embarrassed about it, though.
Well, I guess if you're having fun, that's fine. But in the end, is it really worth the effort to blow somebody off and the any trouble it might be in the future, especially at work? I mean, the truth is, I really don't care. I just want to get in there, do my shit, and get the fuck out after work's done.
Right.
And why do I want to pick fights there? In what way does it make my life better to pick fights with people?
Well, that's
if I don't want to do something somebody's telling me, the best policy, as always, is to simply go okay and then ignore them in the future.
Right. Yeah. Well, it's the economy of a decision, right? I mean, it's you figure out if it's worth in your best interest in the long run to do that.
So. Yeah. I mean, is it worth the effort? I mean, if it makes a big deal, then go ahead and fight it. But in the end, if there's three or four easy ways out of whatever situation you're in, you should really just take that. But sometimes you lose sight of that in the moment.
How are we talking about Scanner Darkly? I totally lost our thread. I was talking about viewing ourselves objectively versus subjectively. And I guess this is sort of a literal version of that. And there's an emotion there in the Bob Arctor character that I guess maybe as he's sort of breaking through the wall or realizing the schism there when he's being interrogated by the medical staff, that I kind of failed to appreciate in the book and in the movie what exactly that kind of epiphany is, or lack of epiphany, whatever the anti-epiphany is, where things cloud over and confusion begins, about what he's actually feeling there. Like, that was me, or that's me, I'm acting. Did you get any sort of what the movie is trying to deliver on that front, or the concept was?
Not really.
Okay. I was trying to make something out of it. I guess I was trying to use the online analogy and sort of viewing yourself in the past objectively as opposed to subjectively, and sort of how belittling it makes me feel viewing myself objectively.
Why do you do that?
Because it's an interesting thought experiment.
Oh. Know?
Like especially when you blow your temper at customer service people or, you know, coworkers or whatever, I always try to put myself in their shoes and think about myself. And it's not a pretty picture most of the time.
Not really. Sometimes you got to do it for other reasons. I remember I had to go argue with some auto mechanics because I had to protect the honor of my girlfriend. So I had to go with her to a fucking dealer where they had run through the ringer because she wasn't really careful about what she asked them to do.
Right.
And basically I had to yell at them a little bit until they allowed me to save face by cutting, you know, some money off the bill.
Right.
Because, I mean, the only reason I was doing it is because Jean was upset because she hadn't really been careful with their dealing and they sort of oversold her on some services, basically, is what happened. So
Did you feel bad about it in retrospect, or
not really? But I don't ever feel good about being mean to, you know, regular working stiffs like myself. I'd rather be mean to some fucking effete asshole, like some guy who works at Amazon or something downtown. I like to kick that fucking hipster right in the nads.
I know. I'm with you,
man. I don't really want to, you know, some poor schmuck making $9 an hour and some shitty mid-test West town working at a call center. There's no satisfaction there.
I know. That's the bummer. Those are the people society gives you to kick around, and they're just like beating up on defenseless animals.
Yeah. I mean, look, I like kicking kittens as much as the next guy, but it doesn't really satisfy me deep down. I need to kick, you know, adult
I need
cats.
To kick hipsters in the nads and skinny jeans and, yeah, that their trust fund bought them. Exactly. Well, I think the thing about the movie is that when I've had a few, I would say, marijuana experiences. I've never done anything more than that. But there's these pathways that open you up and just create this mammoth wave of introspection. I can't even conceive of what that's like on LSD or mushrooms, and that's why I've never tried those. Because I think that introspection would destroy me. I think I would get very paranoid, which is one of the side effects of these kinds of drugs that allow for a ton of introspection. And you start seeing yourself in cruel ways, I would say, if you're of that sort of mentality. There's a lot of people that are like super chill with it. You know, the Joe Rogans of the world that can take psychotropics and psychedelics and you know, drift on through into the openness, although when they come off of it, they don't sound any more intelligent than when they began it, which I always find interesting. People always think, you got to do psychedelics, man. It opens your mind. And then you talk to them, it's like, man, it hasn't done you any good, so why the fuck would I? You're not out there writing new theories about string.
Well, I think you're getting it.
String theory or anything.
I think you're getting at something pretty profound here, Matt, and we've sort of been circling it, but I think we can distill it down that, and I like your talking about how some people get along really well with psychotropics, and I think largely it's because it does allow you to sort of stand outside of yourself and look back, strangely, objectively, even though you're high as fuck.
Right.
Is that, I don't know if this is an old piece of literature, but what I remember it from is from an episode from like the second season of Red Dwarf, where there was a multidimensional being that went around the universe and came to each individual sentient individual and judged whether their life was worthy or not, whether they had lived a good life.
Sort of like some sort of godlike.
Sort of, but what the being did was it actually turned itself into a duplicate of the person it was judging and had that person judge themselves.
Ah, there you go.
And what ended up happening was as this being went through the universe, only the people who sort of didn't have even the ability to judge themselves, who weren't critical of their own actions, who didn't see the faults in their lives, the people who truly looked deeply into themselves and knew how they could do much better, ended up, and the being would erase you from history completely and insert a different, like another sperm made it to the ovum before you did. And basically, in the wake of this being, they would just leave these sort of vapid and vain individuals behind.
Okay.
Because the truly good people who were harsh judges of themselves found themselves guilty of not living a meaningful life. So in a sense, I think people that really enjoy psychedelics maybe there's a certain vapidness to them largely.
Well, I mean, you've met I've met the people in my day in college who were dropping LSD left and right, and you know, it was in college, so they all made it to college, but they weren't people that I found particularly interesting or insightful. And when they were tripping, I definitely didn't want to be around them. I definitely wasn't garnering any sort of enlightenment from being in their presence. I understand it's a personal thing, but I didn't see them benefiting in any sort of way that improved their mental landscape.
No, I don't think it was about the benefit. I think it was
but that's what
it was
they
more
keep
about enjoyment.
No, but that's what all the people, like, I listen to Joe Rogan's podcast quite a bit, and he always talks about, like, the benefits of psychedelics and, you know, how if everybody did psychedelics in the world, then we would all become some sort of super race. And I'm like, I don't know, man. I don't think that's...
Well, maybe there's people who truly have lived good lives like Joe Rogan.
Well, whatever.
And can look objectively at themselves and go, I'm doing all right. Get an octagon with me, you son of a bitch.
For me, I know that would just put the microscope on me, and I'd see every pimple and fat roll of my personality in such a way that would...
I keep talking. You're getting me hot.
I think it would just totally crush me. I think I'm so aware of my... I'm not saying I'm so aware of my weaknesses, because that's sort of arrogant bullshit, but I'm very aware of what I find and dislike about myself. And I think that's where I would hone an experience like that and go on some horrible paranoid trip that I don't want to ever experience. And that's why I don't do it, you know. And I think that's, you know, obviously.
Pussy.
Well, I think that's, yeah.
I have the exact same thing. I don't. I would never take hallucinogenics ever.
So maybe Matt and Mark should do an experiment. We can get into a padded room together and do acid and straitjacket ourselves to both opposite ends, so we don't hurt each other. And wow, that would be a nightmare, wouldn't it?
It reminds me of a terrible horror short story I read sometime. I'll have to forward it to you. Let's not go into it.
Entice our fans.
It was an experiment into drugs where they took individuals and put them in a room. And it was about sleep deprivation, actually.
Oh.
They kept people sleep deprived for long periods of time. And these people ended up going to insane and started vivisecting themselves.
Well, I mean,
I can sort of imagine that.
I don't think I would do that. I think I would just... insomnia has never driven to look at my insides.
You're sort of driven to another sort of hallucinogenic state by sleep deprivation.
That's true.
That's just where that's where my mind goes. We go. I start imagining my arm being torn apart and me seeing all my tendons.
And then me actually helping you along the way
And then I just lose my shit. And next thing I know, I'd end up at a hospital at 4 a.m.
So... I guess as far as the whole drug element of Scanner Darkly, I see what it's getting at without actually getting at it. I don't think I need to experience the life to make a comment on it.
Well, how about this? Let's comment on the use of the word darkly. It's a word that's awesome. It's the
Donnie
antonym.
Darkly. No,
it's
I'm sorry.
It's the antonym of clearly.
That's true. Well, it's a biblical reference.
And it doesn't get used, but it seems like such an incredibly useful word. I just love that. That word is beautiful. It's like it's on my list of favorite words, basically.
Well, it's a biblical reference, right? There's some reference to a glass darkly. We see everything through a glass
darkly.
Yeah,
I think it's the King James version they have darkly. I mean, we call it a biblical reference. It's just a word that's not used, but useful, I think.
What other instance is the word darkly ever used? I don't think it's very, because it always has this connotation, right?
What connotation is it? It's just the antonym of clearly.
Clearly and dark. It is.
I mean, what is the antonym of clearly?
And darkly. Cloudy. How about cloudy?
I mean, that's probably, if anything, it probably means the same thing in the way the word cloudy is replaced darkly.
Well, but darkly, like,
we want to say it has more meaning, and maybe it does because of the biblical business. It has sort of a magical meaning. But in reality, I don't think it has a meaning beyond cloudy.
To get to the title of the movie, A Scanner Darkly is more or less that objective versus subjective view of ourselves, I think. Obvious. I mean, is that obvious? It seems obvious to me when we're talking about... the nature of the film or what the film's talking about.
Yeah, it's about the confusion of the main character.
Correct. So, but it is a nice word, and it's a nice turn of phrase on a glass darkly for the film. Wow.
All right, great.
I just brought it to the hall. How did that happen? Jesus Christ. Sorry, folks. I mean, what happened there?
One character we haven't talked about at all is Donna.
Oh, yeah, Winona Ryder.
And how many Winona Ryder nude scenes are there? I want to really get to the heart of this. And rotoscope nude scene really count in this film? And was she actually nude before they rotoscoped her? I mean, we got to delve into the big questions in this podcast, and let's get down to it.
Can you, Mr. Skin, Winona Ryder? Is that
I wonder if you subscribe to Mr. Skin, which I certainly do not. And you went to the Winona Ryder page, would they list the scene from A Scanner Darkly where Winona Ryder's breasts are out as a nude scene?
Well, okay, back in the 90s, let's say it, Winona Ryder was a hot piece of ass. She was like 90 pounds and had big boobs. I mean, they seemed natural boobs back in those days. So
yeah, absolutely. Yeah, she was. She had a small frame, but big breasts, which is always a plus.
Nice natural ones. Mm-hmm. And she's obviously crazy, so that makes her a little bit more hot, you know. And
Yeah.
I'm trying to think. I think I would have known all the Winona Ryder nude scenes that are out there.
I don't know. I don't think they exist. I don't think she got nude.
I think you're right. So I don't know if this is the exception. And my guess is that she pasted them for the actual shot. That's what I'm theorizing.
Oh.
You know, because you could do anything with animation,
that
right?
Puts an ugly stain on the masturbation session I had earlier.
Well, you had two naked women, and there's the thing where he's in bed with some kind of slutty platinum blonde girl.
I think it's a prostitute.
Oh, is it a prostitute?
Yeah.
And then he looks at it in the scanner when he's Fred at the police station.
Well, that night he sees the face of Donna in the face of whatever the character's name was.
Well, he sees it as Bob and Fred, right? Doesn't he see it as both? Because I thought
Bob and Fred? We're talking about the Connie-Donna dualism. What do you mean Bob and Fred?
Well, when he's there with her, he gets that, he sees Donna.
Yeah.
In the prostitute, right?
Connie.
Is that her name? Connie. Mm-hmm. And then when he's at the police station reviewing the scanners in the house, he sees himself with the prostitute, Connie, and then he freeze frames it because it's actually Donna in a scene.
Well, the thing is, the same moment where he saw Donna's Connie, then transformed to Donna, and then back to Connie when he looked back, is actually extant in the recorded version. The same moment she changes when he noticed the change for a moment in bed, that same change is noted in the recording.
Correct.
So what is that supposed to mean? I think that it means that Donna actually wanted to fuck Bob, but couldn't as part of her employment. So she sort of, put a disguise on or something.
Well, there was the whole thing about, she said, I do a lot of coke. Remember, she said
that. Yeah, it doesn't make any sense. Yeah, but they're talking about that, you know, they're a couple, but it's not constipated either.
Constipated. I never constipated.
Well,
my
if they are doing a bunch of barbiturates on top of everything,
yeah,
they could be sort
up.
Of constipated.
That's right.
We learned
right.
that last week.
I don't think I could be a junkie because of the constipation. Really,
that'd be great. I fucking hate shitting. I'd love to take a few days in between shits.
I cherish my regularity. I swear.
Oh, you're a regular
God.
Man.
As much as I can be a regular man. When I'm not regular, I get really agitated and nervous. It's not a
I'm the back of the stall man.
Back of the stall.
No, I'm joking.
Oh, my God. I just don't want to spend that much time on the toilet. Let's put it that way. So,
well, that's what I'm saying. Constipated would be perfect.
No,
because
but
you only go and poop every 4 days.
No,
you
dude,
save.
Dude.
Just imagine the hours of time you've gained back.
No, because you may be thinking you're banking it, but when you're sitting there trying to force out some fossil of a turd after a week, then it's not going to be much fun.
You get some water-based lubricant in your index finger, and you just go at it.
Do you come on?
Isn't We've it talked just about this before.
Drink your coffee and do your business once a day. Come on, fuck's sake! Do a little Metamucil. Anyway, so...
So was that really Connie?
I don't know. Was that really... Well, that's the blur, right? That's the blur in the movie where you get the overlap of the two characters.
And I don't clearly understand what happened.
I darkly do, so...
And it's amazing that we just said the same thing. Well, God, we really just sort of went all over the place.
Yeah, we're
this,
all
this
over
whole
this.
Scotch business is really making this podcast a goddamn disaster.
I'm sorry. Is this a disaster? I don't know. We went off. I tried to make a point, and that's usually how I derail everything in the podcast, where I'm talking about objective versus subjective. Look at yourself and the enhancement of that through drugs. We talked a little bit about the characters, talked about Philip K. Dick's backstory. Is there anything we're missing?
Yeah. The review. Robert Roten reviewed this movie on December 2nd, 2006 from the rotten heart of the Americas. Laramie,
what?
Wyoming.
Wait, hey, man. Take offense, kind of.
He starts it off with a little bit of a cowboy sentiment here. It takes place in the future society in which corporations have become all-powerful. No, wait. That's the way it is right now.
Amen,
it also
brother.
Depicts government surveillance that creeps into every part of people's lives. Well, that's not far off either.
Yeah, true. Especially,
actually,
I mean,
both of those are sort of true.
Yeah.
Oh, my God.
I know. See, that's what I was muddling through there for 20 minutes at the beginning of the podcast.
Oh, shit. I'm turning into a Corolla here all of a sudden. Yeah. He says, Bob Arctor, the main character, is played by Keanu Reeves of Constantine fame.
Yeah, I know. It's hilarious. The movies that Mr. Roten brings up to, I haven't seen The Matrix, but I saw this movie, Constantine. Yeah, I know.
And also, Don was played by Winona Ryder of How to Make an American Quilt.
I know, that's fucking hilarious. God damn, the least known movies of all these people.
Have you ever seen How to Make an American Quilt?
Oh, you know what? I hate to say that I might have. I think because I had such a Winona Ryder crush at the time that I was willing to... subject myself to a romantic comedy starring her. So,
God, it sounds like a horrible public television program about people quilting.
More or less. It's a chick movie, man.
He does talk a bit about Robert Downey Jr.'s character, Barris, which is a pretty darn good character. He says he's fascinating because he almost makes sense, even when he's talking nonsense. Well, he certainly does have this sort of, I don't know.
The gear scene was hilarious.
They're talking about they know their way around an old Ford POS that they're driving around.
Yeah. Well, they knew a ton about that, but they didn't know about gear multiplication on a 10-speed or an 18-speed.
Yes, it doesn't make sense.
You have like three gears on the back axle, and then you have six gears or three gears or whatever. What is it like for a 10-speed? It was two on the back and then five on the pedals, mm-hmm. Right? Yeah, anyway, but they were counting up the gears, and they were shortchanged, but they didn't do the multiplication.
It was a pretty funny little scene, but it was more just a funny little scene. I can't believe that's in the book.
No, that's not in the book. I like the scene with Woody Harrelson choking in the kitchen, and he just passes out. Robert Downey Jr. just, like, walks over him to go to the fridge, and then he chokes, he coughs it all up, and then stumbles to his feet again. That's a good scene.
Yeah, that is pretty funny, but not from the book.
I know.
Let me see here. speaking about something we talked about earlier, Roten says that I think this film would have been more effective as live action rather than animation. I don't know if that's necessarily the case. I can't say that I have a real strong opinion either way about this. In the way I like the rotoscoping, and I was pleased with it. He comments that maybe that it somehow takes away the facial emotional expression of the actors, and maybe it does, but I didn't find that particularly harmful to the movie, especially considering the main actor is not exactly Mr. Crazy Face.
Well, and the thing is that Philip K. Dick novels have real two-dimensional characters. And it wasn't like you're missing out on a ton of emotion by skipping over that nuance in the filmmaking. It doesn't hurt a Philip K. Dick novel to do that.
Agreeing with the sentiment that I said in a more roundabout way earlier, that the movie has a twist at the end, and it has something to say about current events, although it isn't all that compelling. And that's how I felt about the twist.
Well, yeah, it doesn't, the only thing I found compelling was the blatant nature of New Path that I think is a little bit more camouflage in our society with regard to our, I guess, drug enforcement industrial complex. But it's,
I can't say that I really agree with that. But
all right. Well, I'm not going to debate it for another half hour with you. So
let's get down on to it. Let's do. This is going to be an extra long episode. Yeah. Here's the thing. I strangely agree and disagree with from Robert. He says the problem is that the action is mostly internal, and that the plot is less important than what's happening inside the minds of the characters. The thing is, I agree with that, except that I don't see why that's a problem.
Well, I guess to deal with
I can't imagine you agree with him there. Factually, he's correct, but his opinion is wrong.
How is his opinion wrong, exactly?
That it's a problem.
No, it's not a problem. It's an introspective film.
Yeah.
That's dealing with, I guess, personal issues of each character. It comes out, I guess, in little vignettes that are somewhat of a flashback, kind of, and how a character interprets a scene due to their psychosis. I don't know if it's a problem because it wasn't a problem in the novel. Like I said, Philip K. Dick is a ideas guy, and that's what this movie's delivering to you is ideas and not necessarily plot and action.
He sums it up that this is mainly for Philip K. Dick fans, and he gives this movie a C+, which strangely translates to a fresh on Rotten Tomatoes from Roden, which is, I think, sort of surprising.
He might be a little critical. Over, I mean, you know, like you said, it's for Philip K. Dick fans. I don't know if you as well.
Is this really a fresh review?
This isn't a fresh review. I think it's a splat. But
yeah, I got to write Rotten Tomatoes. I got to improve their system.
Anyway, I guess that well sums it up.
I really enjoyed it.
I like
you were
it.
Just going to say, yeah.
Well, it was trying to pick a Linkletter film out of our 100 directors in our first 100 podcasts here. And he has a lot to choose from. And I could have done a comedy. I could have done like Dazed and Confused, which is a great movie. I could have done like one of the Before movies with Ethan Hawke and Julie Delpy. But I think this movie had, I guess, a lot more to say. And I guess one thing I really enjoyed about it was the fact that it was even made. And especially with Philip K. Dick is that you get usually shit like that John Woo paycheck with Ben Affleck, which was a really great short story. And Philip K. Dick's not really good with the short story, which is kind of ironic because that's how most of his writing ends up in film. But this was like a really careful treatment of something that he wrote, and it was allowed to be made by a studio, an indie studio, and Linkletter had a great deal of control of it, or I don't think he would even bothered with the subject matter. And so that right there is one of the reasons why I respect the film. It's just the truest interpretation of a Philip K. Dick novel put to screen. So,
and that's your objective take on it.
It's my objective non-drug addled take on the movie.
Speaking of drug addled,
speaking of, how are we segueing with that one? I don't know.
Well, our next film, we finally, I don't know, I was looking over, I have a little spreadsheet that says all the movies we've done over the past, well, including this one, 97 episodes.
Yeah.
And we never touched on the Coen brothers.
No, because we would have to do the Everest of cult films, which is The Big Lebowski.
And so our next movie is Barton Fink. Oh, no, it's going to be The Big Lebowski.
Fucking A. Yeah.
I like Barton Fink quite a bit.
it's going to be a challenge because there's so much, strangely, I'd say really strangely, that's been written philosophically about the movie The Big Lebowski.
Somehow, I think we're going to be able to come up with an abortion of a podcast either way.
I think so. I think we can stumble through it. And it's like, remember that scene where Walter tries to put change on the counter and a joint flops out? That is hilarious.
You know, I fucking hate the Eagles, too.
I fucking hate the Eagles. How can we, like, not just quote the whole film throughout the whole podcast?
Well, great. It'll save me problem of trying to figure out my problem with doing props.
I was thinking, is there any part of The Big Lebowski that isn't quotable? Or can you just quote any line in that movie? And no.
I'm here to fix the cable.
Yeah, I'll suck your cock for $100. I don't know. There's like,
let me find a cash machine.
That's right. Should we even bother watching the movie? I don't even know at this point. It's going to be.
I'm going to watch it. Actually, strangely enough, I have it on DVD.
Yeah.
But it's the full screen version.
The full screen?
I know. Can you believe it?
You mean the pan and scan bullshit?
3:4 pan and scan.
It's a fucking crime. It's right there.
So I gotta go fucking get it on widescreen. So that's my mission this week.
All right, his mission, if you choose to accept it. Yeah, that'll be our 98th podcast. I thought you're gonna save that for the big 100, but
nope,
nope. You get a little bit sooner.
There's no sacred cows here.
No sacred cows. So next week will be the Big Lebowski, and until then,
look, I do a lot of coke. Okay.
Crush like biscuit crumbs. I lay down in the bitumen. You have tried your best to please everyone, but it just isn't happening. No, it just isn't happening. This is fun.